The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So most of us, I think, come to a spiritual practice partly because there's maybe some kind of struggle or sense of things could be a little different or a little better, or there's just a sense of things not quite being smooth or right in our lives, maybe in small ways or maybe in large ways. You know, why is it that it always feels like I'm so lonely, or why is it that it just doesn't seem like things, even when something good happens, then after that I feel a sense of letdown. You know, what is this about, you know? Even when it seems like things go well, sometimes we, you know, just have a sense, well, is this all there is, you know, that I have this good job and this, you know, partner, and, you know, we have dinners, and then we, you know, maybe have a good conversation, and then we go to bed, and then we get up and we work, and we come home and we have dinner and we go to bed and we get up and we work and we just like do that all over again, over and over until we die. I mean, is that what it's about? Is that what life's about? And so many of us come to a spiritual practice because of a sense of it's not perhaps feeling like things are quite understandable in our lives. And we want to be happy. We want to find peace. And so the Buddha actually had some suggestions about this. He had some teachings, some offerings about how we might do this, how we might become happier, become peaceful in our lives. And it requires quite a shift of perspective for us. I'll read you a little bit of his words on this, how he says we live our lives ordinarily. He says, an ordinary person who's untrained in the teachings does not understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. That being so, this person attends to things that are unfit for attention and does not attend to things fit for attention. And basically, the Buddha says that the way we attend typically, the way we attend our experience, the way we orient our perspective, is through a sense of I or me or mine. It makes perfect sense, right? We look at everything through the perspective of me, of who I am, of what I'm doing. Like the whole world revolves around me. And the Buddha actually says this is not such a helpful perspective. He says this is attending unwisely. He says, I like this part. I like reading this part because it really points to the kind of things our minds do about ourselves. This is how we attend unwisely. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what? What did I become in the past? Shall I be in the future? Shall I not be in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what shall I become in the future? Or else one is inwardly perplexed about the present thus. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? So this is these questions are stylized, but they're a large part of the way we relate to our experience. When we actually begin to pay attention to our thoughts and begin to pay attention to what's going on in our minds, we see that we are largely oriented around, what am I going to do next? What did I do? Oh, I did that thing, and then that person did that thing, and that means I need to do this thing. And how am I going to do this? And what am I going to do about that? Even if we're sitting in silence in meditation, if somebody walks in the door late, walks it through the door late, it might be, oh, they're disturbing my meditation. We orient everything around me. Pretty much everything that happens, we frame in terms of me, mine, who I am. Somehow, whatever happens relates to me. Even the sound of those cars going by outside somehow often relates to me. Just the other day, somebody said they had the great insight, actually. And it sounds silly. She said it sounded silly to her when she realized it, but it's not. It's actually a pretty profound recognition that when she was driving down the freeway and people cut her off, it wasn't about her. It wasn't about, they weren't doing it to her personally. It wasn't about her. It was about what was going on in their lives, in their minds, in their world. And so this is a shift of perspective that the Buddha offers. He says it's not so helpful, perhaps, to look at things from this perspective of I or me or mine all the time. But it doesn't generally occur to us that there might be some other way to relate to our experience. I mean, how else can we relate to our experience except through the perspective of I or me or mine? What other option is there? It doesn't even occur to us there might be another possibility. Our perspective of me or mine or I is so familiar to us. It's so embedded in who we are and how we think that we don't really often even recognize that we're thinking through that perspective until we start to pay attention to our thoughts. We start to, if just this practice of sitting down in meditation and beginning to look at what our thoughts are doing, the simple exercise of paying attention to the breath and noticing that the mind goes off into thought. That exercise, we think about meditation as being about being present here, to sit here and pay attention to the breath and not have our minds wander off. But part of the exploration is we begin to get familiar with what our minds do when they wander off. And we see just how much they refer to me, to who I am. And often that perspective of I or me or mine has something to do with how I am in relation to the world and where the problems are. It's like, I am frustrated by this thing or disappointed in that thing or excited about this thing or really wanting to have that thing. If I only had that thing, then I would feel better. So largely our inner dialogue, talking to ourselves, includes these I statements. And often, when you start to see them, you see that these I statements also refer to how you feel like things are off with respect to me, with respect to who I am. Start to notice that. Start to recognize that the way we talk to ourselves often talks to us in terms of, this is what I need to get in order to be happy, or this is what I need to get rid of in order to be happy. So we want to be happy. We want to find our way towards happiness, and we think that doing it through this perspective of trying to get what I want or get rid of what I don't want is the way to go. It's been so trained into us. That's the way our culture presents happiness. And you just watch the television for a few moments, and the ads are really about, if you only had this thing, then you would be happy. So our culture supports this kind of self-perspective. It supports this. It teaches us that happiness comes from arranging our world the way we'd like it to be. And happiness comes from having me at the center of the universe. So what's another option? What's another perspective that might be helpful for us? And the Buddha actually offers something. He says that there is something, he says that someone who is trained, someone who is interested in exploring this question of where maybe a deeper happiness comes from, a truer happiness comes from. I mean, even just a cursory exploration of the way we typically think happiness happens. If I only were to have this thing. Even just yesterday, I went to visit a friend, and I had been looking forward to seeing this friend, and we had a lovely lunch together, and I had a great time in that time. And then as I left, I had this slight feeling of letdown. It's like, oh, that's over now. And there was just this subtle sense of, oh, that was supposed to make me happy. Well, it did for, an hour or so. And then it's like, oh, well, what's the next thing I can want? What's the next place I can go or the next thing I can do to find that little hit of happiness again? So the Buddha suggests a completely different perspective on things. He says this perspective of self is not so helpful, but he says there's another perspective that we can look at our experience through that will lead us towards a deeper kind of happiness, not the kind of happiness that comes when we have lunch with a good friend, but more of a balanced kind of happiness that comes no matter what the conditions are. Doesn't matter what conditions are present in our lives. There can be a sense of this is fine. This is okay the way it is. It may not be something I like. It may not be pleasant, but no particular sense of reactivity to it. Just, oh, it's like this right now. The Buddha suggests, here's what he says, wise attention is. And he says that one who is trained understands what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention, and attends to things that are fit for attention. He says, one attends wisely. This is suffering. One attends wisely. This is the origin of suffering. One attends wisely. This is the cessation of suffering. And one attends wisely. This is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So some of you might recognize the framework of the Four Noble Truths in that statement. The Buddha taught this pattern of the Four Noble Truths, essentially. It's really a pattern more than a statement of... It's a pattern that he applied to many, many things in his teaching. So this pattern of this is suffering, he applied to something like, well, this is craving, this is clinging. He applied it to this is the body. This is the origin of the body. So he applied this framework to many, many different kinds of experiences. So we can think about this mostly, as a framework for understanding our experience. And there's two key pieces to this framework. There's a framework, one of the key pieces of this framework is understanding what he means by suffering. That word suffering is a pretty big word. It's a word in English that tends to have a pretty heavy meaning for us. suffering. It sounds so big, it sounds so heavy. We apply that word to pretty large things. We don't tend to apply that word, like yesterday when I was feeling a little bit of letdown. You know, that is what the Buddha is calling this dukkha, this suffering. But that is, I wouldn't apply that word, suffering, that English word, suffering, to that state of letdown. I'd maybe say there's a little bit of a feeling of offness. You know, I didn't feel, things didn't quite feel right. So this, what the Buddha is talking about in terms of this dukkha, this suffering, is a range of experience from full-blown difficulty in our lives when we have partners that die or have a diagnosis of a fatal illness, or we get into an accident and have our bodies, you know, in a cast. The kind of suffering that comes when we lose jobs or partners break up with us, or that kind of thing we might call suffering. Little senses of, oh, I wish it were nicer outside today. I don't like the rain. You know, we don't call that suffering. We may call it irritation or annoyance or frustration. But all of these pieces, all of these flavors, from the very obvious all the way down to just a little sense of, why does it have to be like that? You know, just that whole range is what the Buddha is talking about by this exploration. This is dukkha. And so this framework here, it's framed around this question of suffering. And the teaching that the Buddha offers is actually that the entirety of this feeling of offness can be released. The second statement, this is the origin of suffering. He says that the reason why we have this feeling of offness is because we want something other than things the way they are. We meet the world. We wander out into the world and things are a certain way. And generally, we're not perfectly content in just meeting this is the way it is. We either want to hold on to something because we like the way it is. It's like, oh, this configuration looks good. Let me keep this. This is making me happy right now. If I can keep this, it will make me happy for longer. So this is a form of grasping, of trying to hold on to things. Or we don't like the way things are, and so we resist them or fight them or push them away. So there's that aversive reaction. We don't want things to be the way they are. He says this very movement of wanting itself, this very sense of things are not right the way they are, and I want them to be different, either to keep something that's slipping away from us or to push something away that we don't like. That the very wanting itself, as soon as that wanting happens, as soon as that wanting even comes into existence, we already are experiencing that sense of things are off. It is the wanting itself that creates that offness, the feeling of dukkha, of stress, of suffering, of dissatisfaction. We think that in order to satisfy ourselves, we have to get what we want. That's what wanting says to us. That there's a kind of a delusion behind wanting that says, if you get this thing, this will make you happy. And if you don't get this thing, you'll be unhappy. So that the delusion of wanting tells us that. that we have to act on that wanting. The dissatisfaction tells us the way to satisfaction is to have the thing that I want. And a shift of perspective here the Buddha offers is, why not see what happens if the dissatisfaction goes away? That's not a perspective we would typically have. We are so trained in our culture that when we want something, to try to get it or fix it or change it, if it's wanting to get rid of something, to push it away, wanting to have it, to hold on to it, we're so trained that if we have that feeling of wanting, either we try to satisfy that wanting, or we think, oh, well, I can't have that thing, so let me repress that feeling of wanting. Let me just, I can't have that thing, so I can't have that feeling of wanting. And we push it down. And the Buddha suggested something kind of in the middle. He said, you know, wanting is just a phenomenon that also is an impermanent phenomenon. It will pass. What happens if you, rather than acting on that wanting or trying to repress or pretend like you're not wanting, what happens if you hang out and feel the fact that wanting is happening and see how long the wanting lasts? If it's a strong wanting, it may last for a little while, it may come and go. But many, many of the things that we want will just arise for a moment, and then when the conditions change, that feeling of wanting will go away. And we don't have a sense of a problem about the fact that that desire was not satisfied when that wanting goes away. When the wanting goes away, the suffering associated with that wanting goes away. A simple example. I was sitting in a stoplight, and across the street there was a Starbucks. And my mind immediately created an image of a latte. And it's like, oh, a latte, that would be nice. So yes, it's like that sprung up. There was that sense of wanting that latte. And while I sat there at this red light, that feeling of wanting that latte was there. And, you know, it's like the mind created this scenario, the mind created this image of driving across the street, stopping at the Starbucks, buying the latte, all in my mind while I was sitting there at that red light. But I was aware of this as wanting, and I chose in this case to not follow through on that. So when the light turned green, I turned the corner and drove past the Starbucks. And I noticed, as soon as the Starbucks was out of my field of vision, the desire for that latte disappeared. It was gone. It's a silly kind of simple example, but it illustrates how the wanting, the things that we want, are often very conditioned based on things that we see. I mean, if you watch television, this can happen too. I mean, I notice sometimes if I'm watching something and I see an ad for food come on, you know, I might then get this sense of, oh, food, that sounds like a good idea, you know, and find myself down at the refrigerator. If I can just notice, oh, there's that wanting. That wanting has happened. This is what the Buddha is suggesting here in this exploration. You know, it's like, oh, the cause of suffering, wanting, has arisen. Can you just notice that? Can you just recognize that? This is wanting. It will pass. So that exploration, this exploration is basically about shifting the perspective from I want something or I'm suffering about something. You know, what's suffering? Suffering is often feelings of it shouldn't be this way, you know, or perhaps feelings, emotion. It often has emotional tone to it. It often can feel like anger or hostility or frustration or irritation, or it can also have a spin of pride. You know, we can have that sense of, oh, I'm so great, but then recognize, oh, that feels a little funny. So the feeling of dukkha often has this what we can call afflictive emotion feeling to it. You know, we don't, something feels like we don't want it to be this way, and we're emotionally reactive to that. Rather than it being, you know, why is this happening to me? How can I change this? How can I fix the world so this doesn't happen to me anymore? You know, this person made me angry. How can I get back at them so that I have a sense of control or power? That's the orientation of self. The Buddha suggests rather than that, that we recognize, oh, this is anger that's arising. It doesn't even have to be my anger. Just, this is anger. Anger is happening right now. That one shift, a phrasing in our how we relate to our experience, as opposed to I'm angry. Anger is happening right now. It takes the I perspective out of our relationship to the experience, to just put it in those terms. Anger's happening right now. Frustration's happening right now. Annoyance is happening right now. Fear is happening right now. Confusion is happening right now. These are all forms of suffering. They're just happening right now. So this is a piece of this exploration that he's pointing us to. Can we take the perspective of I out and just observe what's happening rather than identifying with what's happening, rather than having this perspective be about me all the time? Then the cause of suffering, noticing that wanting, you know, when you can. Often we simply notice that we're suffering, but sometimes we actually recognize, oh, what's happening here is that I want this, and I'm afraid that I'm not going to get it. And we begin, so the fear is kind of the manifestation of the suffering, but then we see that the fear is coming because we're afraid we're not going to get something that we want. And so we can come back and recognize, oh, there's wanting happening right now. Wanting is happening right now. Again, not I want, I need, I have to have. This is something this is just what's happening right now. Taking the perspective of I out of the equation, even just in a reflective capacity, you know, just bringing this shift of perspective to how we recognize our experience, if it's just using those words, oh, anger's happening right now, or fear is happening right now, or wanting's happening right now, or not wanting is happening right now. Just that shift of words can help to take the I perspective, to soften it. It may not get rid of the I perspective for you, but it may soften it. And then you might see that there's a little bit more space around your experience, that there's not so much of that feeling of neediness. I have to have this thing. Or it not being okay that anger is present and having to do something about it and control the environment. It's just anger that's arising right now. Can I meet that? The fortunate thing about this kind of practice is that it begins to point out to us that these states come and go. If we can, you know, the very identification with these states, if we say it's my anger, I'm angry right now, what do I need to do about this? How can I fix this or change it? That perspective kind of cements the anger into place. We believe the anger. We believe that it's a problem. We believe we have to do something about it. And I'm not saying, It can sound like I'm saying this. It can sound like I'm saying that if you're angry, then don't take any action. I am perhaps saying, if you're angry, see if you cannot act out of anger. But there's a possibility of seeing that anger is arising. Oh, anger's happening right now. And in that taking the me out of the equation, there may be a kind of an intuitive or a sense of, well, okay, so yeah, anger's arising right now, and this person said that thing, and that wasn't such a kind thing to say. Is it possible to, you know, just respond to that person from a perspective, rather than from anger, from a perspective of compassion or friendliness? You know, perhaps recognizing that what they said may be coming out of some pain that they're feeling. Or to be compassionate to yourself, to recognize it's not okay if somebody crosses that line. It's not okay if somebody's, you know, lashes out and says something cruel. And can you find a way, though, to respond to that, perhaps by, rather than lashing back with cruelty, to state the, you know, what's your reality there? That was very painful to hear that. That was very hard for me to take in when you said it that way. Something along those lines, you know, so that you're not reacting out of anger, but seeing if you can bring in this perspective of, you know, where is the suffering? How might one respond to that suffering with some compassion, with some kindness? That's the other piece here, that when we start recognizing suffering happening in our own hearts, we see that this is, you know, this is not our own domain. You know, that we begin to see as we recognize, oh, anger's arising. As we explore this this terrain of dukkha from the perspective of just, oh, dukkha is happening, suffering is happening, as opposed to I'm suffering. Something in that exploration begins to help us to recognize suffering happens to everybody. And our hearts begin to soften a little bit, begins to open a little bit, that we recognize, wow, you know, this is not just me. This is everyone that has this situation of suffering arising. So this perspective of looking at our experience through this lens or this framework of, is there suffering present? Is there the cause of suffering present? Now, there's not always going to be suffering or the cause of suffering present in every moment of experience, and the other part of this wise attention points to that. I mean, the framework of the Buddhist teachings around suffering give us this idea sometimes that all of the practice is, all this meditation practice is about looking at our suffering all the time. But this this teaching says, no, that there are times when we may notice the absence of suffering. This is the ending of suffering. There is not suffering present right now. And there is also the possibility of recognizing the beautiful qualities or the causes that lead to the ending of suffering. And so this is pointing to the second aspect of this teaching. The first aspect is around this question of what is suffering? How does it come to be? The second aspect is around what does it mean for non-suffering to happen? What does it mean to cultivate qualities that lead us in the direction of happiness, of well-being. Not the happiness that we're trained to by our culture, but a deeper kind of happiness that comes from more willing to rest with things as they are. Not be reactive, let's say, not be reactive to things as they are. Without greed and aversion to things as they are. Just even imagine that, what that might be like if you had no reactivity to what was happening. Something unpleasant is happening, and there's no reactivity to that. It's just something unpleasant happening. If there's no reactivity, no sense that it's wrong or bad or needs to be fixed or changed or that it's an impact or a reflection back on me somehow, is it a problem? Is it a problem? So this exploration of wise attention brings in this question of what suffering is and what it means to understand suffering. But it also brings in this question of cause and effect. So the question of what is the cause of the suffering? And on the other side, what is the cause for non-suffering? What is the cause for moving towards well-being? The kind of well-being that comes more from non-reactivity, a deeper kind of happiness that comes when there's not a problem with things as they are. So there's a set of beautiful qualities, of wholesome qualities, kindness, compassion, generosity, love, along with wisdom, wise intention, acting skillfully, speaking kindly, acting kindly, mindfulness, cultivating mindfulness and concentration, equanimity. There's all of those beautiful qualities that support our moving towards happiness, a deeper kind of happiness. Not the happiness that comes from having things, but it's actually more the happiness of letting go, of not needing things to be the way we think they have to be. So this second part of this formula of looking at this is the ending of suffering, this is the way leading to the ending of suffering, this is the side of the equation where we get to start looking at, oh, joy is arising. Happiness is arising. Happiness is happening right now. What does that feel like? So again, taking the I out of the equation, that may seem a little bit counterintuitive around these qualities. You know, we want to own these qualities. We want to, oh, I am happy right now. But what we find as we explore this this side of the wholesome qualities, you know, happiness is happening right now, joy is happening right now, mindfulness is happening right now, generosity is happening right now, kindness is happening right now. As we take the I perspective out of it, we actually find there's a kind of a deeper sense of peacefulness and ease that comes in when we don't have to own those feelings. It's very interesting, actually. One time this was really clear to me. The way the mind kind of contracted around a beautiful quality. It was a funny way that it did it. There's a wave of joy that came over me. And this wave of joy was really intense. And my mind said, I can't handle this. This is too strong. And so the I perspective was in there. I felt, you know, I felt like I could not be that happy. This was my own kind of flavor of being in this mind and body. I had trained myself so much in the direction of self-hatred and aversion that when happiness started arising, it was like strange. It was not something that I was comfortable with. And so that sense of, oh, I can't handle this. This is too strong. So there was that identification. It was my joy. And I had to either be with it, or I had to do something with it, or I had to navigate it somehow. I was right in the midst of the equation. And then this thought arose, something along the lines of, it's okay, it will pass. And that allowed my mind to let go of the ownership of it. And then, you know, then that joy actually even got stronger. But it just kind of, it crashed like a wave almost. And then it just became a more peaceful kind of happiness. So recognizing, you know, that oh, it's impermanent. That reflection for me was the equivalent of, oh, this is just joy happening right now. It's got its conditions. It will come. It will go. And I didn't need to be in the middle of that. And so that exploration began to show me how even the beautiful qualities, the beautiful emotions, have their own time, their own flow, their own rhythm. And if we kind of get in the middle of it and take ownership of them, it's like we put a filter or a lens or something between the experience, between the feeling and the experience of it. Those feelings, those beautiful qualities will come and go. And without that ownership, there's more of a purity almost to those feelings. They're felt more deeply without that extra added sense of, it's my happiness, it's my generosity, I'm the one that's doing this. So another piece of this, and this will be the last piece I bring in, is I like to think of this teaching as being a kind of a simplification in a way of how we see our experience. We, you know, when we see things through the perspective of I, or me, or mine, there's so many different eyes in there, so many different opinions and views. One of my teachers, Thanissaro Bhikkhu, says it's like we live with a committee in our minds. You know, this part of the committee is over here arguing for this side, and this part saying, no, no, it should be that way. And, you know, so there's all these different opinions and views that the perspective of self holds. And actually, if you start to look at it, this can be an interesting exploration. You know, what we call self, what we call I, actually doesn't stay very static. It changes. One day we've got this perspective, the next day we've got that perspective. When we're relating to things through the perspective of I, things get complicated. When we're relating to things through this perspective of, is suffering happening? Suffering is happening, the cause of suffering is happening. Oh, there's not suffering happening right now, or there are these beautiful qualities that are happening right now. We're relating to it from that perspective. It's much simpler. It's just what's happening right now. Without needing to have an opinion, a view, an idea about what's happening, But just that, oh, this is what's happening right now. So I look at this also as suggesting a kind of a simplification in how we meet our experience. This perspective for me has been really helpful. Just the simplicity of recognizing, oh yeah, this is suffering happening right now. Kind of like, you know, I might be really caught in something, struggling with my practice or struggling with a feeling, depression or loneliness, whatever's coming up. When I'm caught, when there's that feeling of being caught, there's that sense of I'm involved. It's my feeling of depression. It's my loneliness. It's my problem. And then the kind of the recognition or the shift to this perspective, oh, this is just loneliness happening right now. For me, there's like a, whew, oh, that's all that's happening. It doesn't actually have to say something about who I am or what I need to do. It's just something that's happening right now. So for me, this has been a real great simplification and also supports a kind of a, oh, relaxing back. Oh, that's what's happening. It's just dukkha. It's just frustration. That's another good word to use sometimes. It's just. Because that can help take that identification out of there. Because it's not just frustration when it's my frustration. It has meaning when it's my frustration. But if it's just frustration, it can be much easier to kind of let it live its life. It is another impermanent thing. Frustration will come, it will go. Can you allow it to go? The other piece that's been so helpful for me about this practice is the recognition of when I am engaged in exploring suffering. You know, I'm engaged in looking at anger or frustration or, you know, there is such an orientation in this practice to meeting suffering that can be you can almost get a little narrow. You can get a narrow band that's like, oh, suffering. It's kind of like, where's the suffering? Let me find the suffering and look at that. And this perspective also brings in the, oh, if I'm meeting suffering in this way, this is suffering, suffering is happening, suffering is arising right now, then I'm also cultivating mindfulness. I'm also cultivating non-reactivity. So I'm cultivating, I'm on the second side of the equation too. I'm looking at these beautiful qualities. These beautiful qualities are being cultivated even as we meet struggle. Mindfulness is being cultivated. Compassion is being cultivated. Friendliness is being cultivated. And we can shift our perspective from, oh, this is suffering, to, oh, mindfulness is happening. And that's also been a really helpful shift for me, to recognize, oh, yeah, this is a beautiful thing that's happening right now. And there's almost a joy that comes in the very meeting of the difficulty. So there's only a couple minutes, but any thoughts? Or, yeah, uh-huh.
I like what you've said tonight. My question is, for me, boredom happens a lot.
Uh-huh. In the meditation? Or in daily life?
No, throughout the day.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And also restlessness happens. And nobody else I know is bored. And nobody else, and everybody's really busy. And it's, you know, I feel like I should be saving a whale or painting flows to the bay signs on the sidewalk. I feel the world is burning and boredom's happening to me. And I can put distance through with the experience saying, oh, that's just boredom. But I feel very, very badly about boredom happening to me. So how can I make that a gentler place to be since I'm there so much?
You know, part of it is the willingness to I mean, you put your finger on it right there. It is the me that's the struggle. You know, it's happening to me that's really the struggle. So can you, you know, just maybe play with this rewording, you know, okay, boredom is happening right now. Boredom is arising right now. Can you shift the perspective of that? And then the other piece of this is the investigation or the experience of it. Not to just say that, but the willingness to meet, what does it feel like? What is the visceral experience of boredom? What is that experience? That it's paradoxical, but the willingness to meet our struggle, the willingness to meet what feels like it's off, is the path through for to transform it. And so that takes a little bit of a leap of faith, actually. So it takes a little bit of a leap of faith to say, okay, boredom is happening, and this is what it feels like to be bored. This is what this is like. That exploration, you get into the visceral sense of it, and also notice what happens in your mind. I mean, the thoughts that you mentioned, oh, I should be doing this, I should be doing that, I should be doing this. How do those land for you? I mean, you're not doing those things, so I'm assuming that there's something that doesn't quite feel right about going out and saving the whale or painting the curb or whatever, you know. So, but there may be something else that's calling you, and that paradoxically, you may find it through the willingness to meet the actual experience of boredom, and it takes courage. You know, it sounds odd to say it takes courage to face boredom, but it does, because it's not a pleasant experience. So, and the other thing you may find is that there's something hiding underneath that boredom. You might find loneliness, or you might find fear, or you might find sadness. You know, who knows what's there? But the willingness to meet that boredom may begin to allow that whatever is kind of underneath it to reveal itself. And then there may be another, you know, then there's another thing to explore that maybe has a little bit more of a meaning to you than boredom. Yeah. So thank you for your attention. And I'll continue asking for questions at the beginning, and we'll see if there gets to be the courage to ask at some point.